Tēnā koutou no mai, haere mai. Welcome to Q&A. I'm Jack Tame. This morning, James Shaw, frank and reflective on what it takes to create change.
Had it been an option, would you personally have supported negotiating with National?
Yep.
Then, 30 years since the Rwandan genocide, what can the international community do to prevent similar atrocities?
Our international institutions that were set up after the Holocaust in 1945 and everyone said never again, they're simply not doing their job.
And the biggest country in the world kicks off an extraordinary election.
The ruling party in India, the BJP, has often been accused of silencing critics and subjugating non-Hindus.
We'll have that story for you shortly. In a party with activism at its core, at times, James Shaw has stood out for his distinctly pragmatic approach to politics. After a career in the corporate world, he was elected to Parliament in 2014 and was climate minister outside of cabinet for the last two terms in government. But a decade since he entered Parliament, this week James Shaw will address the House as an MP for the final time as he steps away from politics.
We know the causes of environmental carnage and climate change are economic, but that the solution is political. Those are your words from your maiden speech 10 years ago. A decade on, do you still believe them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've been writing my my last speech recently, and I went back and took a look at that, and I'm actually really kind of pleased that I managed to maintain that consistency from when I started through, through the 10 years that I've been here.
I want to break this interview into two parts. We'll do policy first and then do the politics. But just to set the scene for us, where are we in the climate fight? Let's start with the world and then do New Zealand.
It's actually kind of similar here and globally, in that the momentum is building. Things are changing. The direction of the economy is starting to point in the right direction, but it's nowhere near the speed or the scale that we need. I'm pretty pleased that here in New Zealand, actually, there was that recent report from the Climate Change Commission that said that at least as of the middle of last year, we were on track to hit most of our targets, not methane, but the other ones, that for 3 years running, the total amount of pollution that we were putting into the atmosphere had come down, right? And that, to me, was the only measure of success, is like, well, are your emissions coming down? And they are.
That was the previous government's policy, though. Where would we be now?
Well, I would say they've made it harder for themselves to hit those targets. But I am really pleased that they have really clearly nailed their colours to the mast of saying, no, we do intend to hit the targets. So, if they're kind of tossing out some of the things that we put in place to help get there, they're going to have to come up with something else. And, I don't know what that is yet, but, directionally, as long as we're kind of moving towards those targets, then, that fundamental sense of direction is still being maintained.
If we're to measure your success as an MP by outcomes, where does the Zero Carbon Act rate?
I'm always reluctant to kind of get into questions around legacy or what I'm proud of or stuff like that, but it is one of the only things that survived the change of government, and that was the whole idea, was that we had to have a framework that was enduring, that would last multiple changes of government across decades. And it looks like it's passed its first acid test. So yeah, I'm really
what's
that
like? Because obviously, heading into the election, ACT was saying scrap the Zero Carbon Act. National still supported it, but nothing was certain heading into those coalition negotiations. Yeah. Did you fear for it?
No, I didn't, because I knew that Christopher Luxon was absolutely committed to keeping it. I was fearful for some of the policies to deliver. And, I was right about that, right to be fearful about that. But ultimately, I had a pretty good sense that it wasn't up for negotiation, and I'm very grateful for that.
As it stands, National is supporting the Act, but says it's questioning the long-term methane targets. Yeah. What do you think is going to happen with the methane targets under the Act as it stands?
It's really hard to know, right? Because you've got a huge spectrum of opinion. At one end, you've got the kind of groundswell representatives like Andrew Hoggard who are kind of pushing to water down the targets. At the other end, you've got organisations like Fonterra and Silver Fern who are committed to a 2030 target of something like a 30% reduction, which is three times the legislative target. So, it may just end up where you started, because they may not be able to agree on either watering it down or strengthening it. So it might just kind of end up being kept. The 2050 target was never satisfactory, right? That kind of range, 24 to 47%. We asked the Commission for advice shortly after passing the Act, and the advice that they gave us was unhelpful, because they sort of talked about what it needed to be in 2100.
Right.
What I would have wanted would have been a specific number in the year 2050.
Right.
Right? Whether that was 24 or 47 or 30, you know, that... Look, I'm not a scientist,
sure.
But that, you know, that really is up, kind of up to them.
But if it's in the upper band, say it's a 47,
yeah.
Can we achieve something like that with the technologies we have available at the moment without reducing herd sizes?
No, you can't. But you've got to remember that, you know, a lot changes in 30 years, and I think it's entirely probable that something will change. It might be something like a methane vaccine and things that people are working on pretty hard. It might be that consumers change their mind about the product and actually you get significant land use change anyway. You know, who knows, right? But yes, I think it's an entirely doable number.
Is it just that our biggest emitting industry still doesn't pay for emissions?
No, it's not. Never has been.
What responsibility do you take for that?
A lot. You know, so I supported the Prime Minister's move to establish Hiwaka Eke Noa. When we got their final report, I didn't support it. You know, and you know me, I mean, I'm generally kind of like, take the progress, take the win if you can get it. But I thought that the solution that had been developed was not going to work, and it was going to cost a phenomenal amount of money, and it was kind of window dressing that says, we're seen to be doing something without really doing something, and then 10 years down the track, nothing would have changed, and we'd have to redo all of the work again. And I wasn't prepared to let that happen, so I actually ended up on the other side of that.
What could you have done differently, reflecting on your time as minister, to get agriculture to pay?
I think there's a few things. First of all, I think we got the way we organised ourselves wrong, right? We needed single point accountability inside government. We should probably have parked the work with the Treasury rather than with MPI and MFE, because the kind of tensions between those agencies was a big part of the problem.
This is in Hiwaka Eke Noa?
In Hiwaka Eke Noa, yep. So I think we had some responsibility for that. I think the other thing was that in choosing to work with a coalition of the levy organisations, the industry peak bodies, I'm not sure that we had that kind of that group right. If we'd worked directly with, you know, Fonterra, Silver Fern, the big processors, I think that we could have landed on something that was far more sensible.
What about outside of the Hiwaka Eke Noa program? Do you think you could have done anything differently, advocated for a different policy approach in order to get agriculture to pay?
Well, I mean, I initially did, right? So I kind of advocated that we should bring agriculture into the emissions trading scheme, which we had campaigned on, Labor had campaigned on, and even New Zealand First in their coalition agreement had said that if that happens, you know, there was a sort of a conditional sort of support for it. So that was where things were going. And then, you know...
Why didn't it happen?
Well, essentially the industry pushed very hard for a sort of self-regulatory approach, and you know, essentially the government in creating Hiwaka Eke Noa sort of tried to land it, sort of it was bring the industry into the tent, work with them in partnership to try and, you know, to try and land something.
Should the government have been more courageous?
In hindsight, yeah, I think so. It's really hard in hindsight. You know, the difference between our first term, when you had the kind of three-way organisation between us and Labor and New Zealand First, was a very different kettle of fish to the second term when, you know, Labor had the ability to do whatever it wanted.
Yeah.
and so the conditions, even if we'd wanted to do something different, even if we'd wanted to be more courageous, the question is, you know, politically, would we have been able to land anything? I'm not really easily able to answer that question.
Is the emissions trading scheme as it stands fit for purpose?
No, it's not. I mean, the Commission's been very clear about that. It's a lot better than it was. I mean, we put through a massive set of reforms in 2019 and 2020, and you saw the price of pollution went from something like $15, $16 a tonne to $90 a tonne at its peak. Then, you know, unfortunately, the government pulled the rug out from under it, and you know, there was a loss of confidence. We fixed that. but it created so much uncertainty that the rest of the reform program that I was working on didn't really have the social license, and so the government's kind of unwound that.
So if the governments you were associated with were unable to get agriculture to pay for its emissions, what is it ultimately going to take?
You have a number of different levers you can pull, right? So it's interesting to me that the National Party have said that they are going to have an agricultural emissions pricing scheme in place by 2030. Now, I think getting anything through Cabinet and through legislation in this term with the coalition partners that they've got right now is really unlikely. And then, of course, if they are returned in 2026, they've only got 4 years left until 2029. So they're going to have to do a lot of the policy work in this term, and then they're going to have to move astonishingly quickly in the next term if they're re-elected. So, you know, I guess we'll just have to kind of see how that one plays out.
Do you have confidence they'll do it?
No. I do think that the industry itself is now way ahead of where the government is. The fact that you've got, you know, organisations like Fonterra and Silver Fern who have committed themselves to something like a 30% reduction by 2030, you know, 5 years away, is a very, very different position from where we were, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 10 years
ago. Well,
they've
been led by their customers, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They've been led by their customers. I mean, at field days last year, you know, Cadbury had a tent where they were handing out leaflets saying, we're looking for a 30% reduction, and if you don't do it, we're going to stop buying from you, right? Like, they were literally kind of letting people know this is what's coming. So, you know, something is going to have to give.
After the break on Q&A, what will it take to see a National Greens coalition? And James Shaw on a dead rat for which he almost resigned. Hoki Maiti, we welcome back. What's the best way to effect enduring change? James Shaw, it might be argued, had a distinctly pragmatic streak that distinguished him from some of his parliamentary colleagues.
You said that the Zero Carbon Act stands out as one of the few pieces of enduring legislation across governments. If you were to step back and consider the government led by Labor over the last 6 years, did the left kind of blow its chance?
I think that there has been a shift in Parliament. Things are more partisan and more further apart than they've been in a really long time. You can see the kind of the new government coming in their first 100 days, just that massive kind of repeal program that they went through. We haven't seen anything like that in this country in decades. Every government comes in, you know, knocks out a few things, but generally the principle is, if you believe in the institutions and, you know, you kind of want things to kind of, you know, if you don't want someone to come in and destroy everything you've done, perhaps don't do it to them first. I think it's hard to say. And COVID had a lot to do with that, and social media's got a lot to do with that, and the combination of those two things has created a particularly toxic environment. And so, you know, could Labor have done things differently? Yep, probably. You know, there might have been some, things where they might have tried harder to kind of bring National along. But would that have worked under the circumstances? I don't know. You know, we're living in a funny time right now.
You think about something like the approach to tax, for example, and compare Labor's very cautious approach to reform on that front with the way that the current government has acted around the smoking laws or around the fast-track legislation.
Yeah.
At the very least, there seems to be a contrast in the assertiveness
of the
governments. And it's pretty stark.
Yeah. I mean, Labor, especially the Prime Minister, I think made significant efforts to kind of bring the country with them on a lot of things. For some people, including some people in the current government, that sort of manifested as dithering. They sort of perceived it as this just like consulting fest and, you know, so on and so forth. But I think there was a genuine attempt to actually go out and talk to the communities that were affected to say, you know, this is, you know, we need to kind of make some movement here. How can we do this? That does slow things down, you know, when you choose to do it that way. And the current government clearly doesn't have any tolerance for slowness.
Under Labor, you were climate change minister, but you were never in cabinet. And I remember giving you a hard time in an interview a wee while back. And I asked if you had ever been pushed so far in that role, if you'd ever swallowed so many dead rats that you considered taking a moral stand and resigning from your position. And you said, quote, "There are days when you wonder whether it's worth it." So how close did you come?
Really close.
When?
There were a few times. Probably the two most significant ones would have been when we were debating increasing our Paris target, the 2030 target, prior to the Glasgow conference. And New Zealand's target had, I mean, it was an interim target, right, but it had been set by the previous national government. And it really, you know, wasn't equal to our kind of position.
Really?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So that was a really hard fought battle. There were days there where I thought, I'm not sure that I can represent the country as climate change minister if we don't have a target that is at least on average the equivalent of other OECD countries.
Yeah, right.
And so that was one. The other one was the National Policy Statement on Indigenous Biodiversity, which is currently getting unwound. That got really difficult. And I ended up storming out of the cabinet meeting that decided it. And 3 minutes later, David Parker materialised in my office to say, "Look, we're gonna work out a way to get this done." But
Did you ever articulate to other ministers or the Prime Minister that actually, you know, this is, you have pushed me right to the limit here. My position as climate minister is on the line.
Yeah. I remember that morning talking to Megan Woods, and I said, "Well, I've drafted my resignation letter, so, you know, if this doesn't go, then it's been nice working with you."
Had you drafted it?
Yeah. It was honestly that program, get Indigenous biodiversity, right, something that is an absolute crisis. 30 years we'd gone without national direction on this. There had been a number of attempts. I was trying to land something that Nick Smith had started under John Key. The fact that it was so torturous, I'm like, if the National Party could find themselves to fix this problem, surely we can, right? You know, so we inherited a work program. All we were doing was carrying on what Nick Smith had started. And so it just kind of outraged me that it was that hard. And this is, of course, the great irony now, is that the next national government is going to unwind it all, you know, and take us back to before the RMA. You know, they don't just want to unwind the direction that we set up. They want to unwind the RMA requirement to protect our Indigenous biodiversity.
It's interesting you talk about Nick Smith, because you have defined yourself as the collaboration guy, as the compromise guy. I've got another quote from your maiden speech here. "Political tribalism is, I believe, the single greatest barrier to creating enduring solutions to the great challenges of our time. You showed what couldn't be achieved by collaboration and compromise." But what about other members of your party? Do you think tribalism has at times held back the Greens?
Yeah, I do. I don't mean the Greens in particular. I mean all political parties, including the Greens. I think it's something that affects all of us, because we're all kind of players in a system, right? And the system rewards that, but it rewards it politically, but it doesn't reward it in terms of being able to solve those big problems.
Do you think it's a problem that particularly afflicts your party?
No.
Not more than any other party?
No.
Well, let's consider the last election. And I have tried this question on you before. I'm going to have another crack. I'm hoping you're unshackled.
It was before the election, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, this is true. So let's consider what might have been stopped over the last 6 months. If the Greens had been prepared to work alongside National, you might have blocked the repeal of the anti-smoking laws that could potentially save thousands of lives. Mm-hmm. You might have stopped the Treaty Principles Bill, the oil and gas reversal. You might have saved the clean car discount. You could have even breathed life into He Waka Eke Noa. Had it been an option, would you personally have supported negotiating with National?
Yep. And you may remember in that interview, Jack, that you said, if Christopher Luxon calls, will you answer the phone? And I said, well, it'd be rude not to. You know, we would have taken a phone call. And ultimately, because the way the Greens operate, it would be up to our members. I would be very comfortable going to them and saying, you know, here is something, you're not going to like it, but, you know, these are the things we can stop, and we might even be able to advance a few things, and here's the alternative. And there are massive risks and consequences with either way. It's your say. I would have been very comfortable taking that to the members.
Did you consider reaching out?
Well, yes, but ultimately it was up to Christopher Luxon to decide whether or not to call us, right?
From a strategic perspective, do you think the Greens need to be more open to working with National?
Here's the thing. It's not actually been tested whether they are or not, right? So because it's all a hypothetical discussion. I remember a meeting during the election campaign in Dunedin we'd gone out door knocking and phone calling during the day. You know, we kind of went to the pub afterwards, had a few beers and so on. And somebody said, oh, you know, would we work with National to, block ACT in New Zealand First? And I said, well, what do you think? What do you think we should do? And he said, absolutely I do. And I tested the group. There were about 16 of us, I think, from memory. Only one person said, no, we shouldn't. And this is, I have to say, Dunedin is one of our more radical branches in the country.
There always seems to be someone running for the leadership from Dunedin popping up.
and so it really surprised me, right? Because this is the members, these are the activists who are going out every day working really hard to get a Labour-Green government, you know. But when I put the question to them, they were open to the idea that we might do it in order to block ACT and New Zealand First. So I think you'd be surprised at where Green Party members, you know, the lengths to which they will go to stop bad things from happening.
That being said, you with this compromise ethos have had your leadership challenged. Have you ever lost faith in the party, even for just a bit?
No, I haven't. I mean, the thing is, the Greens to me are actually more settled now and clearer about who we are and what we stand for than probably the whole time that I've been involved. And so, you know, whilst, I mean, I think every political party has its kind of internal tensions and debates and fights and all that kind of stuff. We just have a way of kind of conducting that stuff somewhat transparently. so I don't think that's kind of unusual, you know. Yeah.
It has been a tough few months for the party. Gorese Gurumman, Darlene Tanner, and of course the tragic loss of Ephesel Collins. Are you worried that the party is in an especially vulnerable state at the moment?
No, I'm not. I mean, I can see why you would ask the question, but I think that my experience of the caucus and our staff and our members is that, you know, I mean, in particular, there's a lot of grief around Efeso, as you would expect. But, you know, it actually feels like it's in a really good place right now. And, you know, I say that with the basis of comparison over, you know, a dozen years. So I think that's pretty good. And our polling is really high. So I sense that the public are also kind of going, it's a, you know, kind of a rough patch, but that doesn't seem to be changing their kind of perception of the party as a whole and what it is that we stand for.
Before we wrap, there are two specific incidents I wanted to ask about. Do you feel any responsibility for Matidia Tude's political demise?
No, that's an interesting question. No one's ever asked me that before. No, I don't. I don't. I stood by Matidia through that whole time, and it was ghastly. And, you know, I was kind of heartbroken for her about the, you know, the, kind of the way that that ended. And I also, you know, essentially the day after her resignation, had, you know, weeks remaining until the election, and we knew we were in trouble. And so I really just had to focus on that and getting us back over the line. So I'm not sure that there's anything that I could have done to have had that turn out any differently.
What did it teach you?
I think my overriding kind of memory, or the kind of thought that I had of that time, was kind of just being able to, just having to have to park my grief for Matidia and just do the, you know, get up every day, do what you need to do to keep the lights on, and if they're still on next day, get up and do it again, you know. I mean, people talk about compartmentalization, but you know, that's kind of the only word that I can really use to sum that up.
Did you grieve for her?
Yeah. I considered her a friend, and you know, she'd put a huge amount of work in. She was our longest-serving MP. She's a wonderful woman. I mean, she's an amazing woman. It was an absolute tragedy, and I was really hoping to work with her in government after the election. And it wasn't to be.
The other incident I wanted to ask you about is that I'm not sure if you're aware, but you've just passed your fifth anniversary of your assault. Aside from the initial shock and obviously the physical damage, has that had any kind of lasting impact on you?
No, I don't think so. I think it actually affected my family and my staff more than it affected me in some ways, because, you know, for me, the experience was a known quantity. I think for those who are close to me, there's a sort of a fear of the unknown, like, could it happen again, or is there some other damage that we don't know about, or, you know, is he okay, you know, that sort of thing. So no, I don't. And you have to remember that the day after that was the Christchurch terrorist attack, you know, where kind of 50 people were killed. And so, you know, all of our attention had to focus on that, you know.
That's a perspective thing too, eh?
Yeah.
Who's the chief pragmatist in the caucus now?
Look, it would be rude of me to kind of pick, individuals there. But there are people there who would really surprise you to know that they are the ones who have some of the closest relationships on the other side of the aisle. There are people there who I kind of see, you know, with a sort of a quality of relationship a bit like the one that I had with Todd Muller. Mm. You know, I mean, Todd's a conservative Catholic from Tauranga. I'm the child of lesbian parents from the Arrow Valley in Wellington, you know, and politically we were a long way apart, but there was a basis of trust there, and that was really what helped the Zero Carbon Act get over the line. In fact, it was probably the thing, the determinative thing that got it over the line. And I see people with those sort of relationships in the Greens across to people on the government side, and that gives me hope.
Can you foresee a day when the two-party MMP dichotomy is broken?
Yeah, I do.
You think there'll be a Green Party MP who becomes Prime Minister, for example?
I think that is entirely possible. And actually, if you look at other countries where there's been some of the European democracies that are more similar to ours, you've had some very, very, very big changes in political alignment in the last sort of 10 years or so. I think that the conditions here right now, that we may be in a moment like that. I could be wrong about that, but it certainly feels like there is that possibility.
Are you going to restart your stand-up comedy career?
No, that'd be a terrible idea.
How long did that last?
I did a 12-week course in London, at comedy clubs in London. It was an amazing time. It's the most challenging thing I've ever did. Graduation night was at the Walkabout Pub in Charing Cross, and I had to do a five-minute set, and it took me something like 4 days to write and rehearse a really mediocre five-minute skit. And I, at the end of that, I'm like, my respect for people who do that and who choose to, like, do an hour-long show or a two-hour-long show and have it actually be good, you know, I'm just like, and none of them make any money, right? Like, they're all broke. So I'm like, holy heck.
Can you learn stand-up comedy? It sort of feels like this. Okay, you can.
You absolutely can. Right. I mean, there are people in my class who are now, you know, on TV, you know, Night at the Apollo, and there are others who kind of
became climate change minister instead.
Well, there are others who life is funny like that, isn't
it? Yeah.
That is James Shaw. His valedictory address is in the House this Wednesday. So, you know, I also asked him about the tension in the Greens between advocating for social causes and advocating for environmental causes. You can hear his answer and find all of our interviews on YouTube. Just search NZQ&A and we will pop right up. Up next on Q&A, as India kicks off its gargantuan election, we look at concerns about Hindu nationalism and what impact it's having here. Kia ora koutou, welcome back. The biggest democracy in the world is headed to the polls, with India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi the overwhelming favourite to win a third term in office. But on the ground in India, and increasingly in New Zealand, critics are raising the alarm about elements of his Hindu nationalist ideology. Fina Owen reports.
The Indian election is not only the biggest ever, it's probably inspired the most election musical numbers ever, all to get voters to the polls.
It's good, and if musicals help to deliver that message, then why not?
Murali Krishna Magason heads Hindu Youth New Zealand. Like many Kiwi Indians, he's keeping an eye on election news. But Hindu communities are also welcoming some news closer to home.
We're going to look for the land and build this place.
We're in Mount Roskill, and this is Vinod Kumar. He's the former head of the Hindu Council and speaking on the council's behalf today. This weekend, the Temples Committee unveiled plans to build a Hindu youth centre in Auckland, featuring a 40-foot statue of Hindu god Sri Hanuman Ji.
So I said, hey, let's make up a centre and where youth can come to and be proud of it.
Recently, the Hindu councils had to bat off questions about whether a hardline form of Hindu nationalism, or Hindutva, is active in New Zealand. The ruling party in India, the BJP, has often been accused of silencing critics and subjugating non-Hindus. This last week, the hugely popular Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, who's seeking a third term, sparked outrage when he described Muslims as infiltrators. He's been accused of turning a blind eye to attacks by Hindu vigilante groups on Christians in Manipur and hate crime against Muslims, Sikhs and lower castes.
So you don't think those attacks on Muslims or Christians happen in India?
No. If it has happened, it will be, you know, the news might be wrong. Sometimes they say, oh, they killed, this person killed that one. And then when we find out, it's not a Hindu. It's not, so they report it as somebody, you know. And this is how the media plays games with us. As I said, you know, Hindu, if you're following our Hindu way of life, we don't do such things.
This is the Hindu nationalist volunteer paramilitary organisation, the RSS.
So Hindutva, because I have to ask you about that, you don't think that has any elements in New Zealand? You know, they say the RSS, the paramilitary arm, that does not exist in New Zealand in any form.
There is RSS here. We call them HSS, Hindu Swayamsevak Sangh.
Yes.
Okay. So it's, you know, people have labeled it because they're trying to save the, you know, our people. Sometimes, you know, something happens, they go and actually rescue them. They don't have guns, nothing, right? But they teach, you know, our culture and our history and things like that.
And so they're trained?
They train them, you know, to be good nationals.
So thank you for meeting us after a whole day of meetings.
It's my pleasure.
It's quite dark.
The Hindutva ideology's biggest critic here is Professor Mohan Dutta. He says his employer, Massey University, has received letters of complaint about his Hindutva research.
Seeking to silence my voice. And these demands have taken various forms, all the way from demanding that I be fired from the university to needing to seek permission from Hindu leaders in the community before doing my research so that they could be the gatekeepers.
Jai Shri Ram to the entire Bharat.
He was critical of ACT leader David Seymour's attendance at a recent celebration in Auckland of the inauguration of the Ram Temple in India and the chanting of a slogan which has been hijacked by hardliners in India. The clip was picked up by Indian networks.
And on far-right Indian network, on their propaganda, that you have a New Zealand politician chanting Jai Shri Ram.
David Seymour said afterward that he repeated the chant to show respect for the traditions of the group hosting him.
Hinduism is New Zealand's second biggest religion, and like all of the world's major religions, there are various denominations and offshoots within it and beliefs among its adherents.
So welcome, Fenna. So this is the Rotorua Hindu Heritage Centre.
Our growing Indian population has driven a demand for community meeting places like this. Murali, a young Hindu leader, is Rotorua born and bred, and like many young Hindu Kiwis, has re-embraced his cultural and religious roots. He partly credits the Indian leader Modi as instilling pride in being Indian and Hindu. He'd like academics here, who are critical of aspects of the Hindu Renaissance, to engage.
The academics genuinely want to have an honest conversation. It is not like we are hiding anywhere. Hindu Youth is there, Hindu Council is there, Hota Forum is there, so many Hindu organizations are there. You can approach any one of us and have an honest conversation. You choosing not to do that is up to you. People throwing shade, if that's their job, they're welcome to do it. But we go on doing our good work, and our work will speak for itself, really. So
you haven't come across any extremist element within kind of so-called Hindu nationalists in New Zealand?
I have not come across, honestly.
We feel threatened.
On the Kapiti Coast, we meet Oscar Fernandez, an Indian-born Christian who has helped set up the Alliance of Progressive Indians in New Zealand, a safe space, he says, for Indians, including Hindus, who are not comfortable with Hindutva.
Threatened in terms of not a physical threat, but threatening of your social life. You can be bullied, you can be sidelined, you can be discriminated on the basis of you're not aligning to the mainstream Hindutva nationalist politics.
Do you feel you have to be careful about what you say to
yes,
to who?
Definitely.
Q&A talked to several Muslim businessmen in Auckland who said they couldn't appear on camera, one claiming that his retail business had been intentionally boycotted by local Hindus. Have you heard that some Muslims here say that they are kind of targeted or their businesses
no.
have been boycotted?
Absolutely none.
Vinod points out that he and the council are part of an interfaith group with Muslims, Sikhs, Christians and other faiths.
There's nothing, absolutely nothing to fear from Hindus. Hindus are, you know, have been giving. They are givers and they'll be always giving. There's nothing to fear about.
Vote for the gold. Modi ko jayega apna first vote.
Vinod Kumar is confident that on June the 4th, when India's election results are finalised, that he and his friends out in West Auckland will be celebrating Narendra Modi's return.
Fiona Owen with that report. If you want to contact the Q&A team, please kōrero mai. These are our main platforms. You can send us an email, you can find us on X or on Facebook. On Q&A last week, we had an interview with Israel's ambassador to New Zealand, which generated a huge amount of interest and feedback. We know the war in Gaza is a particularly contentious subject, and it's our intention to provide fair, balanced, nuanced coverage of different perspectives relating to the conflict. Over the last several months, we have interviewed a range of people with a range of perspectives on Israel, Gaza, and the Palestinian cause. Next week on Q&A, upon his return from the Middle East, we're interviewing the head of the General Delegation of Palestine to New Zealand. It was suggested by Labour this week that New Zealand should now recognise the state of Palestine and that His Excellency, Dr. Izzat Salah Abdul Hadi, should be invited to present his credentials as the ambassador. You can watch that interview, among others, here on Q&A next week. After the break, it's 30 years since the Rwandan genocide, and the Kiwi who chaired the UN Security Council at the time considers if the world is any better prepared to stop history from repeating. Hoki mai. 30 years since the Rwandan genocide, the atrocities committed against the Tutsis stand out for the profound failure of the international community to intervene. An estimated 800,000 people or more were killed in just a few short months. As New Zealand's former permanent representative to the United Nations, Colin Keating was the president of the UN Security Council as the genocide began in April 1994.
Well, 30 years later, after the genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda, I think the thing that strikes me most is the lessons that we need to learn about genocide everywhere. And the first one is that genocide is actually something that wasn't just 80 years ago against the Jewish people in Europe, or 30 years ago against the Tutsi in Rwanda. I mean, there are still currently allegations today before the International Court of Justice of genocide in the Ukraine, genocide in Gaza. So it's a thing that keeps popping up, and we need to be alert to that. Second thing that I can't help but focus on at the 30th anniversary is that genocide never just springs out of the blue. There's always something, some grievance, something that has percolated a way that has made people really angry, so angry they become irrational murderers of their neighbours. Mm. And thirdly, that we're not completely taking on board the importance of the lessons of this for the international community generally. Mm. Genocide can be prevented, and if it starts, it can be nipped in the bud, but our international institutions that were set up after the Holocaust in 1945, and everyone said never again, they're simply not doing their job.
Mm. I'll ask about that in a moment and what some pragmatic reforms might look like. Can you take us back to 1994? As individual acts, I think the violence perpetrated as part of the genocide, it was just appalling. But what also stands out is the scale and the speed of the events. In your position as chair of the UN Security Council at the time, just how quickly were you aware of what was happening?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think scale is really important. Let's start there. Because you have a million odd people slaughtered, innocent civilians, most of them, in the space of 3 months. Now, for not only me as President of the Security Council, but all of the ambassadors in the Security Council, we were actually dealing with two genocides at the same time. We hadn't yet come to appreciate that that was exactly what was also happening in Bosnia at exactly the same time. I took up being president of the Security Council in April 1994, and Easter weekend, like this year, was right at the beginning of the month. And I went into the office on the Saturday morning and thought, oh, I'm going to do some reading. And it was one of the few valuable, really valuable long-term intelligence reports that I ever read, was one about the history in Rwanda. And I realised that in the previous 30 years since Rwanda had become independent, that they'd actually had three pogroms, sort of almost equivalent to mini genocides. And I was very aware of what was going on in the country. We all in the Security Council were, in terms of the conflict. We had just approved a peacekeeping operation to go there. And there had been a civil war ongoing. I thought, my goodness, if they've had three events like that in 30 years, this could boil up into another one. So I got my head into the space of thinking this could be a genocide. What's not well known, 3 months before the genocide started against the Tutsi, the head of that peacekeeping operation, General Dallaire, a Canadian general, had sent a report back to UN headquarters, in effect saying, beware, I believe that we're going to have mass murders, something like a genocide. Now, for reasons that nobody really knows, the UN Secretariat did not share that information with the Security Council. We know they did share it with some of the major powers, certainly with the United States, the UK, France, but the rest of us were unaware. Now, that was a major opportunity to have actually nipped it in the bud, and it was not taken.
What might an effective intervention have looked like?
Simply at that stage, in 3 months before, simply a significant increase in the forces available. Now, the international community proved in the space of 6 months in Rwanda, twice, that it was capable of intervening. It intervened as soon as the genocide started. The French organised a humanitarian rescue operation in which a large force supported by France and the United States went into Rwanda and evacuated all the foreign nationals. Now, they had the capacity, if there was the capacity to do that in April, once the murdering had started, there was certainly the capacity to do it in January when the warning was heard. And then later, after the genocide was over, after the perpetrators had all fled to the Congo, again the international community intervened in order to establish peace and security for the refugee camps of the perpetrators of the genocide. So twice within 6 months, they did what was needed to stop it all in the first place. There was no shortage of capacity. There was only a shortage of political will.
Let's turn to the events of today. There are many conflicts that give us cause for concern, but you mentioned two earlier, Ukraine and the situation in Gaza. What have you made of the way the UN and the Security Council in particular has handled that issue?
Well, I think the record speaks for itself. We have had, in the space of the last 2 years in the Security Council, 15 vetoes. 15 vetoes. Some of them by Russia relating to Ukraine, some of them by the United States relating to the Middle East, and one by China. Now, and really one this week by Russia in connection with the deployment of nuclear weapons in space, for goodness sake. Mm. So the Security Council is definitely at probably its weakest and lowest point since the Cold War. And there's definitely a need to make some change here. You know, you recall when New Zealand was most recently on the Security Council, when Murray McCulley was the Minister of Foreign Affairs, he and the New Zealand team in New York put a huge effort into trying to get resolutions through the Security Council relating to Palestine and relating to the two-state solution, how to improve the prospects for a sensible long-term political deal. Now, at every turn, that effort by New Zealand was frustrated by major powers, not only the United States, but often the United States, in the same way that New Zealand had been frustrated over issues relating to the genocide in Rwanda in 1994. And I think that hindsight shows that the independence, the energy and the creativity that New Zealand brought to the Security Council in 2015 on the Palestine issue was actually prescient.
You say the Security Council is at its weakest point since the end of the Cold War. What will it take to strengthen it?
Well, I think it actually will take a huge amount. The veto, and I think we need to recognise that it was important that Winston Peters, when he was in New York 2 weeks ago, spoke out strongly against the veto, precisely in the context of the situation in, between Israel and Palestine. But the problem is bigger than just the veto. The veto is a really big problem. But the real, one of the other really big difficulties is that the 10 elected members of the Security Council only serve for 2 years, and they therefore actually don't have the time opportunity to build the experience to run initiatives in an important way. I mean, just imagine in the New Zealand Parliament if a third of the membership of the Parliament was obliged to retire every year and have to have an election every year to replace a third of the members. I mean, governance would be impossible. And so it's not just the veto, the whole structure envisaged for governance is dysfunctional and is probably not fit for purpose. And there's time for a big rethink.
How do we achieve that, though, especially when the P5 are never going to agree to changes?
Well, there's a very big step, a chink of light at the end of the tunnel, I think. Let's be optimistic here. The General Assembly will hold a summit of political leaders in September this year, which is designed to kick off a process of big structural reform of the United Nations. Now, we shouldn't be expecting too much to happen in the space of a week in September this year, but it might just open the door to a much bigger project. And I think there is a time to think about things like the Security Council. 15 is far too small a size for an organ trying to achieve what it has to do. The time that the members are elected is too short. You know, when the UN membership realised that the old Human Rights Commission was not fit for purpose any longer, they just created a new council, the Human Rights Council. When they realised back 25 years ago that the Trusteeship Council, which, like the Security Council, was set up in 1945, it was not fit for purpose, they simply stopped meeting. Now, I mean, I think there are some lessons in both of those previous experiences of mini-reforms about how to reform the Security Council, because I don't believe that in this time in history, and probably not in any time, even in your lifetime, it's going to be possible for any amendment of the UN Charter, a formal legal treaty, to be approved by particularly the United States Senate. I mean, you know, you lived in the United States, you know how hard it is to get two-thirds of the Senate to agree on anything. And in fact, one senator could block a reform of the United Nations Charter. So I think it needs a more creative, innovative way of reforming the UN without changing the Charter. And the UN members have shown in the past with the Human Rights Council, with the Trusteeship Council, that there are creative ways to do that.
That's Colin Keating. Just so you know, I also asked him a question about the Rwanda of today, and he gave a really interesting answer. You can see that on our YouTube feed. Hey, Q&A. Q&A is back after the break. Kua matū. That is Q&A for this week. From the Q&A team, thank you for watching and thanks for your feedback. Ngā mihi ki a koutou I ngā karere. Hei tērā wiki. We'll see you next Sunday at 9 a.m.
Q&A is made with the support of New Zealand On Air.